I deeply believe in serendipity. I also believe it can be engineered. That's how I met Gina Gotthilf, through a selected community of founders and operators looking to build their next thing. Gina was the VP of growth at Duolingo, the most downloaded education app in the world, leading the team that built their user base from 3 to 200 million users. She also led Tumblr's growth in Latin America and participated in the Mike Bloomberg presidential campaign to help oversee digital ad campaigns at a historical daily spend. I knew right away I wanted to work with her. Now, together with Yuri, we're co-founders at Latitude to help engineer serendipity for the top doers and thinkers in the LATAM startup ecosystem. In this episode, we talk a bit more about what we've been up to, but mostly about Gina's journey, her challenges and learnings. Stick around to find out what hypergrowth startups are really like from the inside, some of the growth tactics early stage founders can benefit from, her biggest F-ups, and her takeaways from pitching Duolingo to President Obama in the White House. My name is Brian Reckworth, and this is Latitude Podcast. Awesome. Well, Gina, welcome to the Latitude Podcast. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here. I've heard such great things about you on this podcast.
Well, thank you. This is kind of fun because we're co-founders and we're building this together. Share with everybody a bit more about your experience and your perspective, and then I'll share my perspective on kind of how we met. Kind of a fun story. It involves a podcast potentially. And then I have a ton of questions of things I want to ask you.
Yeah, totally. So I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do next. And I knew that I wanted to start a company. I really wanted to be an entrepreneur. And I had a couple of ideas. At the same time, I was undertaking this crazy journey where I bought a car and decided to drive across America and was really in the most random places ever the whole time. Because, you know, it's 2020 and this is the time to do things like that. And I remember being in the middle of a trail in a forest somewhere, participating in a session, the On Deck Fellowship, which I was participating in order to meet a co-founder and potentially figure out what idea I wanted to focus on. I'd been thinking about what, you know, how great it was to meet people like this and meet such smart potential entrepreneurs that I could work with and discuss the future of everything. As I'm kind of walking through the forest, I'm in this little session about how to make your own podcast, because I'm thinking of making my own podcast. And I hear someone just chime in and be like, hey, like, you know, I'm Brian, and you kind of introduce yourself. And like, you know, I'm thinking of building a community for founders in Latin America. And I remember thinking, wait, no, that's what I want to do. And Brian, you had actually emailed me previously being like, hey, you're Brazilian. I made this podcast in Portuguese. You should listen to it.
Yeah. My perspective was like, we're part of this community. And so I read about your profile and I'm like, wow, like, and we'll get into a little bit more about the history of like what you've done in terms professionally and tell a little bit more about your story. But I was like, wow, here's this person from Brazil, clearly very accomplished. So I was just basically looking to vibe out with someone else that had been part of success stories. And I assumed that you had connection with Brazil, given that you're from there. And you were very candid with me. You're like, hey, I'm driving across country. So, and then fast forward a few weeks, I think we'd scheduled something a couple weeks out, because you're like, I'm consulting, I've got customers, I've got looking at starting something else, I've got driving across country. So you had your plate full at the time. I think I had told you, hey, I've got a podcast, and here we are.
Exactly. It's funny that it was about a podcast, but also I remember our very first call where you like, it became very evident to you that I hadn't actually done my due diligence for that call. I didn't really know about Viva Real. I didn't really know about you. And once I realized what a huge gap that had been and how embarrassing that was, and I was so embarrassed about that, because I called my friends at Endeavor in Brazil. I was like, have you guys heard of Brian Reckworth? And they're like, duh. And so I started researching, felt really bad. And you sent me, you're like, hey, look, I wrote this book. You should check out the manuscript. And I, in a way to apologize without having to really, I don't know, you know, I said, I'm sorry, but to prove that I was really sorry, I read your book from cover to cover that same day and sent you a bunch of like...
You're one of the first people who actually read it, and a few others gave like really constructive feedback. And when I got your feedback, I'm like, wow, okay, this is, you went above and beyond. And that was kind of a very clear sign as I was also looking to start something that I'm like, oh, I want to work with this person, just the way you were thinking about things. And so that's a little context for everybody. And speaking of podcasts, you also planning on launching your own podcast, which is set to launch here shortly. And you're planning on detailing your biggest F-ups and asking interviewees to share their biggest F-ups, because that's not something you hear all the time. So in the spirit of a nice prelude to what you're about to launch with your podcast, I got to ask you, you know, what is your biggest F-up?
Yeah, I think that's just a question people don't really like to address very straight on, you know? So I could be like, oh, Brian, my biggest F-up is that actually I did, you know, this press campaign for Duolingo, and it was so successful that it took the site down. And that was a big mistake. You know, I really should have like been a little more cautious. That's, I think, the kind of answer you hear a lot. And, you hear it and you roll your eyes, but I think that it really perpetuates this vision that this image that entrepreneurs or people who succeed just have this amazing ability to be right and successful all the time. And that's the opposite from the truth. So for people who know me personally, I feel like I stumble every day. I'm stumbling in the right direction and things are working out really well, but there's a lot of stumbling involved. So to answer your question, I think one of the reasons why I'm excited about Latitude is that I really feel like the biggest F up in my career is that I had some pretty sharp ideas about companies I wanted to start building when I was in my early 20s. And I was too scared and I didn't do it. I also almost joined a really early stage startup that I was very excited about, got scared and took a job at a more established company. Of course, I'm not telling that everyone, you know, who's listening that that's the right way to do it, to go to start a company or to join an early stage. I regret that fear because I think that even today, the ideas that I had had would have been really successful. And I just didn't do it because I was afraid of losing my visa because I was trying to stay in the United States. And I worried that if I had a side thing, I don't know, the IRS or someone would catch me and I didn't know exactly what the rules were. But that said, I F up a lot just in my day to day. And my funniest one would be that, you know, I worked at Duolingo with CEO and co-founder Luis Fuanon pretty closely. And I took him to an interview once, 1 month before the actual interview date by mistake. Like it was the exact same date and the exact time, the exact location. We get there, it's closed, like the office is closed, and I'm like getting really flustered and I'm like calling them and like, why aren't they there? And I realized it was exactly 1 month before and I just started working with them and it was extremely embarrassing. Oh, also I booked a flight of mine for the day before as well. So basically just a lot of dumb mistakes that made me look really incompetent.
Every single success story has tons of screw ups along the way, right? And that's something that people don't talk about. And so I'm glad to hear there's a podcast that's, you know, one makes that a little bit more like accepted because it's just the stark reality of every single success story. And so I think that's going to be fun to go into that. The classic kind of saying is you learn a lot more in those hard times than you do in your success, you know, your high points. And I'm sure you're going to be able to explore a lot of your own kind of mistakes. And I hope to be one of your first interviewees on your podcast, because I essentially wrote a book about this, of all my screw-ups. There's a good chunk of my book. So
I'll consider inviting you. I'm not sure yet, but I'll
thank
you.
Hopefully I make the list. So on the flip side of like some of these screw-ups or challenging moments, kind of at the polar opposite, you've done some pretty cool stuff. And one of them is pitching just low-key President Obama. So how did that happen and what did you take away from that experience?
It was one of the most incredible days of my life. And I remember telling Luis Fuanon right afterwards, you know, I think my career has peaked. I'm going to walk away while I'm at the top and I'm done. Like I'm going to retire and go do something very simple because I don't think this, anything can top this. At the same time, I recognize that it's funny because it's a moment that's highly recognized by everyone as like this amazing feat. So like I use my photo with Obama everywhere because it makes me look super legit. But it was just a moment in time, you know, and it doesn't actually, to me, like represent the stuff that we accomplished as Duolingo or the stuff that I've accomplished in my career. But it's kind of a badge of honor that everyone recognizes because everyone likes Obama and he's a big deal. But the way that happened was that the White House had their first and probably last demo day. And they decided to invite startups from all over the United States to showcase the amazing entrepreneurship from all corners. Duolingo is one of the selected startups to go present, but it was like a list of 30 or 40 startups. And we were invited to go to the White House. So I always, you know, I was the second spokesperson for Duolingo for 5 years. So I was always there to present, whether at conferences or any other opportunities of this type. So Luis Bonan and I went to the White House. And I remember him being like, you need to know that this is, you know, this is an Obama event, but he's not going to be there to like, you know, manage your expectations. And I was like, it doesn't matter. Like, I'm excited to go to the White House, not as a tourist. Like, it's going to be such an interesting experience. But I felt really nervous that day, and I actually dressed up, like, I don't know. I was nervous, and I was just like, what if Michelle's there? What if Obama? But he was like, seriously, I've been to the White House twice already for events, and he's never there. And I was like, okay, well, that's fine. And so they took us into the White House, and they took us to the very last, like this room all the way in the back. And I remember saying to Luis, we're being taken to the loser room. Like, we're totally being taken to the loser room. Because there was like, they spread it out all over the house. And there were like four other startups that I hadn't heard of before in the same room with us, in the loser room, right? And one of my best friends is a journalist at the New York Times, who's a huge like theme for American history. And she's like, what room are you in? Like, what are the paintings? And I'm like, I don't know. There's some men on the paintings. And it's like, I hate you. You're useless. And we're there prepping our little like booth, you know, because it was a demo day. I thought it was just a demo day for people who work at the White House. And these people keep coming over to me and being like, hi, I'm sorry, but your computer is not perfectly aligned with the table. And your poster is not at a perfect 45 degree angle. And I remember being like, why are they being so annoying? Like, who cares, you know? And Louise looked at me and was like, you deal with this, and walked away. And they were like, we're going to have to hear your pitch. And I was super jaded, being like, we're an app and we do languages. And they were like, we're going to need you to work on that. And I was just like, you guys, I do this like a million times a day. Like, I know what I'm doing. I didn't say that out loud. That's what I thought. So finally, something clicked that it was weird. And someone said something like, does she know yet? And I was just like, I'm sorry, do I know what? And they were like, nothing. And I was like, you guys, on a scale from 0 to 10, what are the odds that President Obama is going to show up? And they looked at each other and they said, 10. And I remember just like my legs, like it felt like they weren't there anymore. And Luis heard this and starts pacing back and forth. And he's like, how can you just stand there? And I was like, I'm wearing heels. I think I'm going to fall over. Like, I'm just standing here trying to not fall. And in my head, all I was saying was like, Gina, be normal, be cool. And like 3 minutes later, Obama walks in. Luckily, like we had like those 3 minutes to be like, okay, Luis, you say this, I say this. Like, this is how we're going to split it up. We kind of knew our pitch pretty well, but it was fantastic. And yeah, we got to pitch Duolingo to him and have a whole dialogue about the importance of language education and how he wished he had had Duolingo growing up. And then he shook my hand. And I didn't let it go for like a second too long because I never wanted that moment to end. And it was also his birthday. I really wanted to have sung happy birthday to him, but the person who did this before was also a blonde woman and things didn't go super well there. So I kept quiet.
And so, well, that's really a special kind of experience and quite a surprise, I guess. And, you know, you were ready for the moment, right? You made it happen. Any kind of other observations, like give you any feedback, or how did you feel like you did? Like, because I mean, an interesting phrase that from Oprah's interviewed like hundreds, if not thousands, of like extremely successful people, including Obama. And one thing that she's known for saying is that after the interview, doesn't matter who it is, the number one question is, how was that? Because people are just insecure, no matter who they are, right? In fact, President Obama literally said that to Oprah after. So, how did you feel afterwards? And did you get any feedback?
Yeah, let me tell you about the feedback I got, because it was actually pretty direct. Weeks later, this goes online. This is on YouTube, so you can actually find this interview. Please don't, and I will tell you why. This interview is online, and some people start commenting on it, and some guy decided to narrate my play-by-play during this interview. And like every second, he's like, and then the blonde girl laughs for no reason. And then look, she looks down, but there's nothing there. And she says this thing that is out of context. And like, he's spot on every single second. And the person who found this was my intern at the time. And he just like sent it to me like laughing. And I felt so embarrassed. I mean, so I really liked it. I think I did a fairly okay job given I was presenting to President Obama.
Yeah.
I got through it. I didn't die. Like it was done. But you know, the feedback was pretty harsh in terms of that one guy, but he really got to me because I feel like he was narrating all of my insecurities during that time. And I know me, I like to hide behind my humor. And so any opportunity I got during that interview, I was just laughing because that's the best way I had to like not freak out completely. So that happened. But the other cool thing that happened, we went out to dinner after that and actually ended up running into all of the photographers from the White House and befriending all the photographers in the White House who told me amazing stories. They've been there for, you know, a very long time with a lot of different presidents. And that's how I got all the photos that they took of us, because they move like a little bush, you know, like in the cartoons, like with the camera. So I remember standing there and these little men with the cameras, like moving like this, like right in front of us. And there were like 20 cameras. So we met all of them. And that was really cool. But yeah, that was it. And it will never happen again.
Yeah, well, not with Obama. And hopefully, anyways, we won't talk politics. So, and by the way, this, given the theme for your podcast, this is actually bringing up a lot of like moments for me of like things that I've screwed up, right? Public speaking. I'm reminding you so that when you interview me, if I make the cut, ask me about my complete blow up in public speaking. Okay. I have a good story for that. Okay. So we'll save that for another day. 'Cause it's not about me. So Duolingo success story, you've built a reputation as someone who really has mastered growth and been able to take, in the case of Duolingo, when you joined, there was 3 million users. And then by the time you left, Duolingo had 200 million users. And this was done all organically. And you've talked about strategies more in detail, one of them being PR, and it's often overlooked. Share some tips and tricks for that, if you would.
Sure. So in terms of tips and tricks, I think the most relevant stuff to talk about is the growth team that I led. We were a product team of engineers, designers, product managers, and we ran experiments all day long, every day, a bunch of experiments a week to improve percentage by percentage, different little different aspects of the actual product. And we looked at it really broadly from a marketing and growth perspective. So we were A-B testing all of our emails and notifications, which is kind of how to bring people into the app. We were A-B testing like our app store presence in terms of ASO, but we were also A-B testing the actual product. So focusing on onboarding, for example, like the minute someone downloads the app or signs in or checks out the Duolingo website for the first time, how do we get them to do all the things they need to do in order to become a user that loves the app and comes back again and tells their friends and goes through that whole funnel? And so there are countless experiments that we ran. 50% of them on average failed. We don't talk about them. We only talk about the successful ones. So it really goes back to that theme. But the successful ones really made a big difference. For you to have a perspective, and this is not from my team, this is from the early days of Duolingo, because that team has always been focused on product retention and growth. But day one retention improved from 15% to 50% over the course of, I don't know, maybe probably something like 1 to 2 years, just by running these experiments and optimizing. Now, the important thing about this, especially as you and I, Brian, are working very much with early stage companies, is that it's very difficult to effectively run A-B tests at that scale, because you need to have statistically significant results. And in order to have statistically significant results, you need a very large number of people using your product. So you know for sure that if something works better than the next thing, it's not by chance. It's actually statistical. Like that if you do it again and again and again, you will see that to be that will actually remain true. And then you can make changes and optimize. So yeah, happy to talk anytime about like any of those specific ones and the ones that work the most. I don't know if you want to go that deep.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to highlight like the number one channel for you, you know, what would you say is what was the breakout thing? If you were to kind of strip, because you end up doing a lot of things, you test things and you end up doubling down on things. But if you could highlight, if you had to strip away everything and it's like just one thing, what would that have been for you? And how applicable do you think that is to most startups?
I think that the most important thing is to focus on retention and to have one metric that you care about. So we cared about day one retention, the number of people who come back one day after they download Duolingo. And so all the experiments around that, I think, were the most important. And the most notable was experiments around push notifications. Basically, like how many words, what words, should there be an emoji, should there not, what time of day. Like we've figured out that we should be sending notifications 23.5 hours after the person signed up, because we assumed that at that time they were available. And so the next day, there's a chance that at that time, they're going to be available as well. So a lot of experiments around that, we saw a big difference in terms of usage when our push notification system broke. And that's how we know that it was so effective. But I want to highlight just the importance of looking at retention and day one retention for apps, you know, that fall into this category of daily usability. Because a lot of people, when they think about growth, they think about acquisition. They think about, what am I going to do on Facebook? How much can I acquire a user for? Like, how can I get this in front of people? And that's a really important part of the puzzle. But the retention piece is whether people actually find your thing useful or not. It's kind of like the product market fit piece. If you can't retain a user that you got, not only is it like, it means that your thing isn't very useful to that person and in general, if you can look at that at scale, but also it's just from a pure math perspective, that's just a huge leaky bucket, as they call it in the growth community, which means you're paying money, you're spending effort on getting people to try your product, and then you're losing them immediately. So you might as well spend upfront effort on keeping them around for as long as possible, because you know then that every dollar you invest in getting new users will go that much further because that user will stick around longer. I think that's applicable to any startup. It's like focusing on product market fit and value, which is measured by retention. But that's all it is. Retention is, did the person like the thing and use it again?
Yeah, I love the OMTM, you know, the one metric that matters that you mentioned. I think that that's something that, like, focus is so important. And I think the startups need to be obsessed with focus and prioritization, because I think the number one problem for a lot of startups is they chase a lot of bright and shiny lights. And the reality is honing in and focusing on one thing, you can unlock a lot of value. When we were building Vivaral, we had the challenge, and it's kind of the blessing in disguise, which is, We were broke ass founders with no money and no access to capital for a long time. And so we got super smart at driving traffic organically and finding those metrics that we didn't require a lot of capital. I think that you're very well known for having built a growth engine without any money really and spending money on marketing. How important is that to have as the right DNA kind of when you start and you're looking to, you know, to grow your business?
You know, it's hard to speak generally because I think that there are some startups in which this might be different. But I guess all I can do is speak from my own experience. I think it's extremely important that you're able to acquire users without spending money on it, because once you start spending money on getting users, you become addicted to it and you can't stop, because then you have like this number and you're trying to improve this metric and you can't completely lose it. And you're depending on those users in order to work on your other things. And it just becomes a vicious cycle where you're just constantly trying to get more users, and then you burn through, like, I don't know how many potential users for your business by presenting them with something that isn't necessarily a great fit. And so by focusing on the organic piece, it's just a fancy way of saying you're making sure that the thing you're building is useful and people want it, and that you're focusing on who wants it and how to get it to them. Because if you get it to the right audience and it's a good thing, then people will want it and they will use it. I know I'm simplifying it massively, but I do believe that's super important. And so thinking about how to get those users without investing and thinking about CAC and LTV like first thing, I would say is very important. Of course, those metrics are extremely important in terms of unit economics for any startup. But if you have to keep going to Facebook to like keep buying more users, it's going to be really tough to maintain in the long run. You're going to have to raise more money. And basically, I would be scared as a founder to go down that route.
Yeah, and you build a massively competitive kind of moat if you're able to do that effectively. You can charge less for your products. There's all these benefits
absolutely. And by the time you start running ads, then you have a lot more information about who your audience actually is and what they like and what works and what doesn't work. You're not just blindly A/B testing ads and throwing money at it, kind of like we did with the Mike Bloomberg campaign, but that's another story.
Yeah. A lot of times, from what I've seen as an angel investor and an advisor, a lot of companies, there's a bit of a facade, kind of like what we talked about in the beginning, where it's like, everything's great. And like, it's the classic question. And you ask a founder, how are things going? And it's like, oh, it's amazing. And it's just like, there's no way that every single founder, things are going amazing, because the reality is startups are filled with turmoil, right? I mean, it's kind of one of those things where like people put on the Instagram kind of lens, right? Where it's like, things are going great. And there's always challenges. A marriage has its challenges. You know, when you look at it from the outside, there's always challenges that are going on. You're navigating it. Life is hard. So what was that like at Duolingo? Did it always feel like things were moving quickly and up and to the right? Tell us more about that. Because from the outside, Duolingo is an amazing story. And I mean, it's a company that you helped build. You should be proud of what you guys did. But people don't always know what it's really like.
Yeah, no, definitely not. We're super lucky, and we're one of the big success stories. So yes, I think more so than in other cases, but on a day to day, it did not feel like that. It felt like a lot of work. Like often we didn't really know that the direction we were going in made sense. We were trying things. A lot of things didn't work. Like I said, over 50% of our A/B tests failed, meaning like they didn't produce any results. And that was a lot of work thrown out. And so people get really demotivated. I think that the hardest thing, like if I were to name just one, but there was like, in terms of like people leaving, like we had really great retention overall, but like, you know, there's one person who leaves, who like says this thing, and then now the press caught up with it, or we posted something on social media and it offended people. Like once I tried to post something about inclusion, and it was like a huge, like the person, there was a person in the office who came to talk to me about how it was so tone deaf. And we had to delete it. There was a day when we tried to do a global launch, and actually like a Pittsburgh newspaper, broke the story, meaning they made the whole global launch like invalid after having emailed 200 journalists all over the world. So there's every day was another thing. But I think that the toughest one that I actually put a lot of effort in trying to navigate very carefully from the, so that the outside perspective was positive, even though it felt very scary and could have been seen as hugely negative, was that we actually changed our business model completely. We pivoted entirely. And so a lot of the Duolingo story is based on the whole concept that Luis Fanon invented, CAPTCHA and reCAPTCHA. And so this sort of killing two birds with one stone approach of, you know, translating the web while proving that you're not a bot, but having people type things that the computer can't recognize. We, with Duolingo, was the same thing. It was learn a language, translate the web. And so people were translating things while they were learning. And it was a brilliant and really great idea. And it kind of worked. And so we started selling translations. That was like our first business model. We sold translations to BuzzFeed and CNN. Those were the first two clients, translating all of their content into Spanish first, and then into Portuguese, with people who are learning languages on Duolingo and like editing each other, kind of like on Wikipedia. Having to realize that wasn't going to work long-term for a number of reasons. First, because just like the unit economics of like the translation business is a mess. You're haggling over cents basically for per word with other companies that are competing against you. And language is complicated because you translate something one way and someone says, that's not the right word. It's this word. And we would get into like all of these back and forth. And then most importantly, we realized at Duolingo that if we went down this route, then we would be making money from translations. We wouldn't be making money from education. And our investors would quickly say, why are you guys spending so much effort on the education piece? Your money is coming from translations. You focus on translations, because obviously. And so it didn't work to have a model that really didn't align with our whole mission of bringing free language education to the world. And since we still had runway, we could pivot. But from a public perspective, that was a disaster, because it would basically just say our thing isn't working. Everything we've been saying was a lie, or that would be the perception. But yeah, I think we were able to navigate it, you know, with a lot of care in a way that made it, you know, very seamless. But if you really knew from the inside, like the day-to-day struggle of like stressing out about this change and not having a business model that actually works, we had to go from that to let's go explore new things versus let's go from that to this that we already know works. It was just like a year of like, we don't have a business model. We don't charge for our products. We don't have any ads. Like we've made a whole point about not charging and not having any ads. Like, what are we going to do now?
What point did that happen in your journey? Was this like, because pivots happen, ideally you're pivoting early so that you're not deploying so much capital like behind an idea that isn't validated. But when you joined, it was like 20 people in the company or something. It was a very early, and now it's a very, you know, a very large company that, you know, probably will go public at some point. And tell us more about what stage you're at when that happens, and how did like, was it harder navigating the team's kind of motivation, or was it harder to navigate the investors, or both, or your own internal kind of like battle? Talk a little bit more about what were the challenges there.
Yeah. And I wouldn't need to look exactly, but I would estimate that we were around year two, that we had already raised a Series A, maybe Series B, somewhere around there. So, you know, not as early as you would have thought. I think that we got away with it because we were able to grow in terms of users so quickly. And we were building a product that definitely had value for people, and we're retaining it. And because Luis Fanon, you know, has all this reputation, so the investors really trusted him. So that's where we were. We already had BuzzFeed and CNN as clients. So, you know, that took a while to negotiate and everything. In terms of our fears of backlash, there were a lot of cases where we really feared internal motivation. This was not one of them. I think that our biggest fear was the external perception of the brand, the company, and what we were doing. So that's what we were really careful to navigate. But internally, yeah, honestly, like even just the decision to to have management, to actually have like teams at Duolingo instead of just like a completely flat organization, or the decision to consider ads or to consider ways of making money or having things that users could pay for, caused many people at Duolingo to threaten to quit, because we were kind of very early on, it felt like a communist little society where everyone was like, we're all fair, we're all equal, everyone's the same, we don't charge, we don't believe in management, we believe money is evil, we're only doing things for the good of the people. And then having to be like, cool, we love this mission and like this passion, but also we're a business and we need to pay everybody without saying that, because, you know, so that kind of thing really was tough to navigate internally as well. Like aligning people with the mission of doing good with like doing that while also having a business that functions, that has a structure, that makes money is okay.
That's something that usually the best companies start out with, this ambitious mission. And as a business, you obviously have to make it sustainable. And, you know, otherwise you can have an ambitious mission, but if it's not designed to kind of be sustainable, it's going to be hard to be around forever. And then you won't be able to execute on your mission because you'll run out of money. You mentioned something interesting I want to double click on. It sounded like there was a little bit of like a very flat hierarchy in the business. At what point did you guys start, you know, building out executive team? You know, I know that you were, you know, outside of growth, you were also on the executive team. Where was the moment where there started needing to be kind of like managers inside the company, and how did that all kind of take place?
It all took place like step by step. It was tough. It wasn't like a band-aid that we ripped off. I think around year two also is when you started having more of like, oh, now some people are going to be promoted to managers, but we didn't call them managers. We just called them team leads. So for example, I was a team lead because that was a way of not saying management, and it really took a long time for people to accept that there was more of a structure. I think things really, really changed around maybe year three. I think that's probably when we started having an executive team. And in my opinion, things really changed when we hired someone called Natalie Glantz from Google. She was, I believe, a director of engineering there, but an incredible woman. She's still at Duolingo today as head of engineering. She really brought a lot of the Google structure to us, and like the importance of keeping to OKRs and yearly planning and being serious about documentation and structures and team orgs, establishing a cross-functional organization and all of that. And then I feel like it's a week-by-week process. It wasn't like a one day we decided to do that type thing.
And of those kind of advances in the company, and by the way, I'm thinking of all kinds of things that I can share in your podcast, of things that I screwed up as I ask these questions.
Great.
You've planted a seed in my mind now of like going full vulnerability on all of my screw ups. And great. It's amazing. It's amazing how like when you're talking, how easy that comes up when you're thinking about your own story. Because usually you kind of ask questions and then you also reflect on your experience, right? When you ask those questions. And so of those kind of key elements of transitioning more to a professional company, you mentioned OKRs. What do you think were the most mission critical elements of becoming more of an organization versus this startup going after this lofty idea?
To me, like I said, like the Natalie moment was a big one in terms of implementing OKRs, cross-functional organization and all of that. Let me say that I don't know. I never really, I think, had a real heart-to-heart with Natalie about this, and I hope that maybe with my podcast we'll be able to do it. But I feel like her entrance into the company was one of the hardest. It must have been so hard for her because she not welcomed with open arms, because it was a team that didn't want to have all of the structure and didn't want to feel corporate and didn't want to have kind of like someone who felt like someone who was telling everyone else what to do. But I think that like her entrance and her steps really like transformed Duolingo from like a child company to like a young adult type company. So OKRs, huge, and really sticking to them, because I've worked with organizations where it's like, oh yeah, let's do OKRs. And then the founder is like, oh, but can you sneak this one thing in? And the next week it's like, but can we prioritize this other thing? And it's like, we already established the OKRs. There's a reason why the process is like this. And the answer is no. But then, you know, it's tough if the founder doesn't buy in completely and the management team doesn't buy in completely, because then it's just really easy for it to kind of fizzle. And also really being very careful about how you actually write down the OKRs. It's a lot tougher than I think people think in terms of creating key results that are actually measurable and objective that are just right. And really thinking about how you word things and the metrics that you're going after makes a huge difference in the long term. That's one. The second thing is implementing a sort of a hiring plan and being very careful about how we hired. At Duolingo, I think even very early on, it was pretty tough to actually get hired. The bar was very high, but the bar got higher and higher, and the process got a lot more serious, and people complained about it a lot because no one likes process. But I really think that it made it so that we could only hire people who were excellent, never people who were good enough for that job, because we really needed someone right now. So I think that made a really big difference in the long term. And then the third thing that I like to talk about, and I think is super important, is that we established three pillars early on. I would say maybe around fourth year, where we realized that we had competing goals in the team, and we had people leading teams that were going for goals that competed against each other. For example, number one goal, you know, from a mission standpoint, is to get people to learn. So our learning metric was the most important thing. Establishing that metric was super important. But we couldn't really teach people if we couldn't get people to use Duolingo. So growth and getting a lot of users was super important. And that's like a whole other goal. And then, of course, none of this could be sustained unless we made money. So monetization became the third pillar. Three things that are important. These things work against each other in ways that you wouldn't predict. For example, if I want to get a lot of users to stick around, I will make really fun and easy lessons that are kind of like, you know, have like animations and you always get it right. And there's always someone telling you that you're amazing. You collect all these points. That's great. I could actually measure that this would impact retention positively. But this, from the learning standpoint, is not good because you're trying to get people to challenge themselves so that they can actually grow and learn. Alternatively, you could just give people really tough things to get them to learn more quickly, but then they'll give up and then they won't stick around. So they're not learning anyway. And things you do in order to improve either of those metrics could be charged for at any point. So like, you know, our team came up with a streak freeze and the streak amulet, the weekend amulet, which was basically ways for you to protect your streak from going lost if you forgot to do Duolingo on the weekend, which is kind of a little bit of a cheat, but like it was just like a way to get people to keep going on Monday. Once we realized that actually worked, our learning team was like, you're cheating. Like, we want people to actually do this every day. And I would say no, because if they don't do it on the weekend and they fall off on Monday, you just lost your learner. And then what's the point? And the monetization team would be like, wait, you're doing this and we're not charging for that. We have to sell that amulet. People want it. And I'd be like, no, because if you sell it, people are going to buy it and then they're going to stop using Duolingo. And like, it was this thing. And so like, there were examples like that where it felt like we had to go into like the judge room or something, the courtroom with the rest of the executive team. Sometimes it was just the co-founders, and make our case and actually argue against each other and come to a conclusion together about what was best and how to measure X percent plus in growth minus X percent in monetization. What does that amount to in the long run? Because if we didn't have that, I think we could have really gone in one of the directions and derailed metrics long-term that really mattered.
So it sounds like best ideas win. You've got to debate and you've got to make your case, and everybody, you have the North Star for the company, but this tension that's created, do you think this tension is good in startups where there's like a kind of a push and pull? And how do you strike the right balance?
Yeah, that's hard, because it could get heated sometimes. I think that it's important to have the push and pull because it means people really care and they really care about their metric and they're really like, their team is super focused on that one thing. So it's important for people to feel passionate about what they're doing. And if they're fighting for something, then it means they're passionate about it. In this case, it was best ideas win, but it was best, like, the, you know, the three pillars could have best ideas. But then like, if one was hurting the other, it was very complicated. And I feel like that might be the case more often than we understand. So for example, we always wanted to stick to the mission. So whatever was best for the user and best for learning is what we all actually really wanted to do deep inside, because that's what we were there. But we needed people. We needed someone like me to be like growth and the other person to be like money, because otherwise we would just become like a nonprofit or something. And then we couldn't actually hire the best talent, and then we couldn't actually keep the servers going, and then people couldn't learn at all. The end, it's not the best thing for the users. I think it's important to give people a room to voice their opinions in a way that is structured and productive, instead of them feeling like it doesn't really matter that the executive team will make a decision one way or the other. But yeah, it's a balance. That's a hard thing. Just encourage communication, I would say.
Yeah. And I think that communication becomes even more challenging as the company grows, right? Did you sense any kind of growing pains? I mean, there's, you get to a point where you don't know everyone's name. Those things ultimately result in challenges. And people oftentimes, you'd mentioned that when Natalie came, all of a sudden there was a little more process and a little bit more, like, people didn't want managers and things like that, which is super common. And in fact, Google is famous for not having managers at one point and then actually doing an analysis, like a mathematical analysis, that resulted in showing and evidencing that actually managers are really important and people want them. And so that's great that you brought someone from Google, because Natalie could probably articulate the lessons and learnings from Google, and then people are more receptive to it, particularly engineering types that like to have very evidence-driven decision-making. So talk a little bit more about kind of the context of that and how you were able to scale as you go from 20 to 50. And some of the companies that are listening, maybe at that moment right now, what advice do you have for them?
Yeah, from 20 to 50, I think that's one of the hardest growing pains. Like maybe from 40 on or something like that, it starts feeling like a different company. The biggest advice I would give there is, there's an article that I read at the time that I really liked called something like How to Give Away Your Legos. And I think, I don't know, it might be on First Round now, but it was somewhere else. How to give away your Legos is important because you're used to kind of wearing all the hats early on at a startup. And you like to complain about how it's so tough that you wear all the hats and you do all the things, right? But then as soon as you have someone who's doing one of the things that you were doing before, it feels weird and you don't want to give it up and you don't think they're doing a good job. And for a lot of employees, especially, it feels like you're losing your power. It feels like you're being sidelined because, like, let's say I own social media. Now I have someone who took over social media. It's like, why? I've been doing it. I've been doing a good job. Like, why not? It's like, yeah, but you should be focusing on this other thing now, because that's kind of the whole point, right? You start very small. Everyone does everything. And then you hire specialists who can take over and do maybe even, like, hopefully a better job than you could at all the things. They can do a better job at that one thing. And you need to be able to learn to give away your Lego so that you can grow in your organization as an employee, get a higher, like, management position even, but also for the organization to scale. It's the only way. So I think, to me, that is the best advice.
I like the Lego analogy. So kind of transitioning a little bit, what an experience at Duolingo and an opportunity to be on a rocket ship, expanding globally. Before Duolingo, if we kind of take a step back, you led Growth Tumblr in Brazil and LATAM. And growth was not this growth thing that it is now. It was really wasn't something that people talked about in the same context. You had no team or structure and also no budget. So kind of going back to what we discussed earlier, how did that work out for you and what worked and what did you attribute the success to?
Yeah, I like to joke that they hired me because they had no other choice, because they were like, we don't know anyone else, but can you do this? We don't know what this is, but just make us grow, please. No budget. Also, like, we're not going to tell you anything. Just good luck. And it's funny because, you know, we ended up getting all this press being like, Tumblr opens an office in Brazil. And it's like my bedroom in my parents' home was the Tumblr office. That in Santo Grão, which is like a cafe I really love in São Paulo. So yeah, growth wasn't really a thing. I didn't have the chance to use money to do Facebook or whatever kind of ads, which is also why I'm very biased towards organic. So I had to think about how to get Tumblr in front of Brazilians, the right Brazilians, and how to make it super useful to Brazilians, which goes back to the retention thing, which I didn't really understand at the time. So there's a couple things that we looked at from a product perspective, even though, again, I didn't know I was looking at anything from a quote-unquote product perspective, and I ended up doing PR. I didn't know it was PR. I just thought it was emailing journalists. So I feel like I was young and kind of trying a lot of different things. One thing that I noticed alongside the Tumblr team in the US was that people in Brazil, which is where I started, you know, the Tumblr launch in Latin America, were discovering Tumblrs by sharing links with each other on Facebook chat. So they were being like, check out this cool page, and like send it to their friend. But they wouldn't even say it's a Tumblr. They wouldn't know it's a Tumblr. They would just go to that page, check it out, laugh, and close it. And that's it. Not great for a brand that wants to get recognized, grow. And also eventually I thought that what they would do would be to put ads in there or something like that. So having people be on the platform for a long time would be really important from a monetization standpoint. And so the first question was like, okay, how do we get people to actually understand that they can log in and create FOMO so that they want to keep scrolling and realize that if they didn't come back tomorrow, they're going to lose important content. So then it became a content strategy. It's like, well, what content would they feel like they're losing? Well, first of all, there's news. So if we can get news in a really fun way and people feel like, oh, you know, Veja or Folha or whoever like publish something really important and I'm missing out on it, then they might want to go on. And then also some of the other like pillar areas of Tumblr, like art and humor, and kind of trying to understand how to beef up those in from a Brazilian standpoint at first, and then eventually like Chilean and Argentinian as well. So going and actually selling all of these organizations on creating a Tumblr. And the way I did that was by using my digital media like marketing experience that I had before, where I knew after having worked with LVMH that once you create a social media account for a big brand, they feel the need to populate it because they don't want a dead page online that someone can find and see that they're like not doing a great job. So I knew that if I created a Tumblr for one of these, there would be a high likelihood that they'd actually like go and feel the need to populate it instead of just being like, cool idea, we'll add it to our list of ideas and maybe we'll get to it in a year. So I'd be like, hey guys, I think you guys should do a Tumblr. Here's why. I have like all of this like stuff in English to make it look even more legit. And here's what this one newspaper, this one art gallery or whoever in the US is doing Tumblr, and this is how it's working. And I will actually start it out for you and I'll write the strategy out for you. So I would go and like create the account, actually start it out, actually tell them what to do and then leave it. And I think that that really helped get things going super quickly. And so we really beefed up the content side. We developed the community side. So I ran their biggest meetup with 1,300 people in Curitiba. A lot of people crying about how they were happy that they found someone that really understood them on Tumblr, which was my first like view into like the importance of an online community and what kind of things that kind of unlock beyond the whole like, oh, the internet actually tears people apart kind of thing. And then PR became a huge thing, which was just thinking like, okay, what journalists would be interested in Tumblr and at what angle about Tumblr? Like, well, so in Latin America, it was easier at the time because I just thought, well, you know, there's these American founders and they're in New York and we have these like big brand names in the US. So I think that I can interest Latin American journalists just with the possibility of interviewing these people. And so that was my first sort of like hook. But then figuring out what are the stories and what are the angles and who are the users and what is the content that most interests the press, and finding them on Twitter and on LinkedIn and being like, hey, like, you know, there's this thing. Do you think you want to cover it? That really worked out super well. And creating other opportunities for press. So for example, in Chile, we went to the Casa de la Moneda, which is like the White House in Chile. And we had a meeting with their head of communications about how to use Tumblr to better communicate with young people in the country. Or in Brazil, we had meetings with, I don't know, again, like the top art galleries and some important artists. We would come up with a content strategy that would then allow us to contact the press and say, like, this is a really beefy, interesting story. Like, for example, the Chilean government is actually really concerned about communicating with the younger population by using technology. That's an interesting story. And then you can leverage, you know, Tumblr in there. So it ended up also becoming an item on the playbook that I used for Duolingo when I went and worked on government partnerships in Mexico, Colombia, and New York in order to then get the press story that would give us legitimacy and a lot more users.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. You have a big megaphone there and it's not about talking about yourself. It's you've got to have the right story and you've got to be able to create something of interest for people. And you've got to make it easy for the journalists as well.
That's exactly right. Journalists doesn't want to write about your product or about your company. They want to write about something that's important in society or about people. And so if you can find a way in which your product or your company actually helps or does something significant for that trend in society or for those people, that's your story.
Yeah. Just as a side note, this is probably not going to go into the podcast, but I thought of another thing that I screwed up with journalists.
I feel like I need to like make, we need to keep notes during this podcast so I can properly interview you.
Yeah. Yeah. This is serving as a good outline for the things that I can share on my screw ups, but no. Well,
I can share a funny one real quick. One funny F up, and this is not mine. So it's kind of funny that I'm sharing it, but I'm sure he won't mind. But Luis actually in talking to press in Brazil said something like, he made a joke, you know, for people who know me, like I make a lot of jokes and some of them don't land super well, but they are meant as jokes. Luis did something like that. And we were speaking to Brazilian journalists and he said he made a joke like, you know, Ashton Kutcher is so incredibly smart. Like you wouldn't expect it because of That 70s Show. But the way that the journalist wrote it down was like, Louis Von Ahn believes that it's like, it's surprising that Ashton Kutcher is intelligent because he doesn't appear to be, or something like that. And Ashton Kutcher is one of our investors. And I'm just like, you have to delete this. Like, there's a journalist, like, you have to delete this. And they're like, he was like, no, it was said, I'm printing it. And I'm like, you are just being a jerk right now. Like, you need to delete this. Like, you're taking down a company for no reason. So we had like this whole argument back and forth about like, in fear that like Ashton Kutcher might see this little story in Brazil and think that Luis said something negative about him. If Ashton Kutcher does ever listen to this podcast, Ashton, you are incredible. You are so smart. You are so successful and beautiful. Thank you. Bye.
and my quick story on the media, the press thing is that I had gotten my first press ever. In fact, part of the Latitude community, Alan Colmenares from Swap, he actually was a guest writer on VentureBeat that would syndicate to the New York Times business section. And so he wrote an article about what I was building, and it was like an amazing article. It got us all kinds of press. And I had been pitching Sarah Lacey, who at the time wrote for TechCrunch, and she was an author, pretty well known. And I actually pitched Sarah Lacey by saying, look, you should write about me because the New York Times wrote about me. So it was like the biggest insult to her, because she's like, I'm a journalist. I get scoops on stories. I'm not your press monkey, you know? And that's,
oh no.
And so that was like my moment of embarrassment on trying to get her to cover what we were building. But just complete, like, you know, lack of understanding how it works. Right.
Totally.
So, and that's part of what we're building with Latitude, right? We want to bring and democratize access to best practices and help people, you know, empower people through a community. And so
it's so easy to mess up. It's so easy.
And the easiest way to teach is to make the mistakes and then share your lessons, and which I think is why the podcast that you're doing is so important and so necessary.
Yeah. And your book also, that's your entire book. So please buy Brian's book. Thank you.
Thank you. So more recently, let's kind of fast forward here. You worked as a growth lead on the Mike Bloomberg presidential campaign's digital team. Share a few lessons about that experience.
Yeah, sure. So I think the number one, probably, you know, we spent like a very huge budget. You can Google about it later, every day at that campaign because we could. And a lot of the team, I would say the entire team that I was working with, was very focus on how are we going to create these ads? What's the creative? What's the copy? What's the targeting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, what are we doing with these ads? And to me, it was just a very clear blind spot to not focus on the second part of that equation, which is when someone clicks on the ad, what happens then? Like, how do you actually capture that person in a way that's meaningful? And so just hoping that your ad's amazing and targets the right people and then sending them to a crappy landing page is just a big mistake, because if that landing page has a low conversion rate, then every dollar spent is worth a lot less. And so I spent a lot of my time, we worked very long hours. There were no weekends, there were no holidays. So it was a long time, but it was probably like 3 days. I spent 3 days that felt like an eternity trying to convince the team to pay attention to this, and they wouldn't. So I finally decided that I was just going to do it myself. Like, the designers wouldn't want to do it. The copywriters like just couldn't prioritize it. So I was like, fine. And then like figured out how to use Unbounce and like how to like build like very simple landing pages and with like trying different designs and different copy, figured out how to be able to like get some of the traffic that they were testing with the ads, and then was able to show, look, like this one landing page went from 2% to 14% conversion rate in the matter of 2 days, because that's the amount of budget that we were using. This doesn't normally happen. It takes like weeks and weeks for you to be able to improve like one percentage point because you need the statistical significance. But because we were spending so much money and driving so much traffic, we could actually see those improvements in real time. And then I was able to get the resources I needed to get the design people to like help me out on this, and the copywriters help me out on this. But I think what I'm trying to say is, if you're going to work on any sort of campaign, really think about both sides. Like, how do you get people somewhere? And then what happens when they're there? So if very simple example is like, if you have a little store, like, and you have this amazing campaign to get people to check out your store, when they walk in, if it doesn't appeal to them, they walk out and like your whole effort was for nothing. So you need to make the store show exactly the hat that they wanted immediately, so they'll go and buy it. And in this case, we were just trying to capture emails. Second, is something that I knew but was very visible in this campaign, which is you need to scale your team slowly. I believe in being very careful with hiring. And I see a lot of startups being like, we got this cash. Like, we're going to go and hire everyone that we need. You can't, because people are not puzzle pieces. They're not chess pieces. People need to jibe with each other, and they need to be able to like complement each other's abilities and fit into the team in a way that is cohesive. And the teams need to work with each other in a way that makes sense. And that's really hard to build. So we had the most amazing people working on email marketing. And then we had the most amazing people working on capturing email leads, but those teams didn't talk to each other. And so from a very tactical standpoint, that means that I'm attracting people who are interested in, let's say, they get like banning gun violence or ending gun violence. And I'm like using petitions and imagery that go against that. And people go and they give us their email. If I give it to the email team, they need to then serve them with content that's about gun violence and not about saving forests and, you know, the importance of, I don't know, whatever, like paying attention to global warming, because then there's a disconnect. And so hiring very slowly is the second thing that I would say there. And then the third is the toughest one, which is like, you can have the most amazing marketing team and you can build stories and imagery and whatever, but the product at the end of the day, if the product isn't right, if the product isn't what people want, there's nothing the marketing can do. And I think, you know, I don't mean to get political. I love Mike Bloomberg and I have a huge respect for him. And I honestly think he would have been a tremendous president. However, the fact that he couldn't hold his own in that one debate made it so that it didn't matter anything we had done, how many millions of dollars, how many optimizations we had done. Like, that was just the pure product in front of the people. And that was when we lost it all.
The product speaks for itself and you've got to deliver the goods. Otherwise, it's not going to work out. I mean, what an interesting experience though. Like, you get to be thrown in this like crazy campaign, unlimited resources. It's a very quick way to learn very fast. But you know, I think that a lot of founders forget about the whole kind of product cycle and too much concentration on acquisition. Mm-hmm. But if you don't focus on acquisition, it's the funnel is in other portions. And I think on the hiring kind of comments, that's something that definitely a challenging thing. And when you've got success and you've got growth, a lot of time that masks problems, right? Because if everything is, it looks like it's going well, like the numbers are there, eventually things catch up to you. And so if you're not being really careful on the hiring portion, a lot of conflict and challenging internal situations in companies are often bad culture is masked a lot by growth. If you're growing really well, the culture thing isn't as evident, but when things are really challenging and they're going how you want them to, then those things become more evident. So I think that's a good reminder for all the founders to be thoughtful.
Yeah, agree 100%. And I think it's personally, like in terms of growth, I think it's funny that one of the growth metrics that people like to boast in terms of startups is like how many people are working in their company or how many people they're managing.
Yeah.
People are like, oh, I have a team of like 50, I have a team of like, I know it sounds impressive, but it's actually not a metric that matters at all. And it actually could be working to your detriment.
It could have an inverse impact on your success. I remember like feeling proud about that at some point and then quickly realizing it was definitely the wrong metric to look at. And so much so that as I start my next thing, I'm literally clear that I don't want to have a lot of people. Like, you know, I don't want to have a huge team and I want to scale the impact through software and other things. And we need to have a team that's capable, but I'd rather have like really high quality people than 500 people that are not making a huge impact. And so it's not about having warm bodies. It's about having those people that can generate a massive impact in your business.
Totally. I think Instagram had like 7 or 8 employees when they sold to Facebook, as an example.
Yeah. WhatsApp as well, right? WhatsApp had a very small team. So as we close out this interview, it's been a fun chat. I hope you'll really consider me to join you on your podcast. I'm willing and able to share all my embarrassing moments over the years that I've learned from. But I guess I got to ask you, you know, after living in the US and working in these global facing companies for 15 years, you know, why did you decide to join Yuri and I to build Latitude? It's not too late also, but we hope that you'll continue on. We like working with you.
Brian, I know some incredible entrepreneurs who work at global companies who are Latin American, and they've chosen to leave their country to go to the United States and build their company there. So for example, Mike Krieger from Instagram or Luis Vanan from Duolingo. I want it to be the case that the best entrepreneurs and the best minds of Latin America will stay there and build companies there. And I think that we are at a tipping point where this can actually happen. We have amazing talent. We have excellent ideas. We have problems in Latin America that Silicon Valley founders could not begin to understand, that are super scalable problems because they are experienced by a lot of emerging countries and developing countries all over the world. There's capital in Latin America now. I think that with the pandemic in particular, investors in the US are starting to look outside the valley and maybe even outside the borders of the United States to make investments. So I think there's a lot of conditions that make it so the time is ripe for some very impactful companies to be developed in Latin America. And I believe there are simple things we can do to help create a condition or an ecosystem that's a little bit more similar to that in Silicon Valley. First, a real community. I think there's no real community of founders in Brazil or in Latin America. There's still a little bit of a competition approach. Not that there isn't competition in Silicon Valley, but you meet each other and everyone shares resources and knowledge and that kind of, there's tremendous value in the little day-to-day learnings that come from someone telling you what the best growth channel for them was or what VC they spoke to or what designer they hired. And Latin American countries face a lot of similar problems that they're trying to solve, but they're not talking to each other. And I think there's amazing talent to be found across borders and knowledge to be shared. As a region, we're huge. I think we're powerful and we can solve big problems that can then go on to more of a global stage. So per your question, I think a lot of Latin American startups are not becoming global only because they're not striving to be global. They're just striving to be the best X in Brazil or the best Y in Mexico and not thinking from the start, like, how do I think about this from a completely global standpoint? I'm hoping that with my experience in globalization for Tumblr, Duolingo, and other companies, I can help with that. And you, with your amazing experience in creating an extremely valuable company that is well-known across the region and making you one of the most well-known entrepreneurs in Latin America. And Yuri, with his deeply technical knowledge and ability to make things happen expertly. I think the three of us have the potential to really just help nudge amazing founders to be much more successful by not allowing moments of failure that are easily preventable. Just like, oh, I wasn't able to raise money or I wasn't sure how to validate my idea.
Gina, last thing I'll say as we end here, fechando com chave de ouro, as they say in Brazil, I would say that a big word for me in kind of over the years has been serendipity. And it's been kind of serendipitous to meet you. We started kind of working on some ideas together, hadn't met in person. And then coincidentally, you were kind of 45 minutes away, having driven from New York, landing 45 minutes from where I was living. We met in this like digital world, in this crazy pandemic where no one was actually going out and meeting people. I'm grateful for that. And I'm really enjoying kind of the first steps on our journey here. And I think that the key word here is serendipity, but I think you can actually engineer or manufacture serendipity by putting amazing people together and sharing resources, as you said. So I'm very bullish on what the opportunity is, what lies in front of us. And I think that the team that we're assembling and the founders that we've met is really the start of something exciting. And so I'm really enjoying being on the journey with you so far.
Same. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to give back. I think that by helping the entrepreneurship ecosystem across the region, that can be one of the most powerful ways to impact the economy of these countries and to generate jobs in the long term. So I'm really hopeful for what we can do together.
All right. Well, thank you. And I look forward to maybe being on your podcast.
Okay. Thank you, Brian, for the opportunity. I will make sure that all my assistants consider you.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Latitude Podcast with Gina Gotthilf, co-founder of Latitude and former VP of Growth at Duolingo. Each week, we'll be talking to great founders and investors like her. So be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts and check out latitude.com to find out more about the Latitude Fellowship Program. I'm your host, Brian Reckworth. Until next time.